atom that has too many protons or too many neutrons. When there is, let's say, it is used in medicine cut, right? When you have two protons that collide with electrons, and now when you have a proton colliding with the electron, and then both of them inhalate and create two rays, one 180 degrees, one from the other. What was cut enters here.
Wesley, I'm not quite sure. It sounded like you said that when an electron collides with a proton and then you went off, and I think you meant the positron. So I think what you were discussing was the mutual annihilation of particle and antiparticle. But it sounded to me as though you said proton, not positron.
Sorry, my mistake.
Yes, Jeff wanted to say something. So, Jeff, please.
Just one addition. I am not an expert on this topic, but I walked by this beamline many, many times. There was one beamline at NSLS, the original NSLS at Brookhaven, where they generated, gamma rays, and it was from the impinging RF, and I'm perhaps actually not RF, but maybe UV on an X-ray beam. Which would generate gamma rays. And I'm not 100% certain about this, and I would be embarrassed to even claim that I know anything about it. Just saw the diagram on the wall and walked by it many times. So go ahead, Roy.
Okay, so unhappy atom, I call it unhappy atom, right? Is decaying, and we have a positron that is trying to escape. In some cases, but not all the time, that positron is colliding with electron because they have the same mass but different sign. They inhalate each other. Then you have two different particles, well, we shouldn't call it particles, those are X-rays, rays of X-ray. They are 180 degrees, one from the other. So one is going left, the other is going right. And then the device, the device that is using it for medical purposes, is it the CAT scan?
No, it's a positron emission tomography. We had a lot of talk about that way back in one of my earliest TechNet experiences. That's when we finally had a radiation oncologist to back what I said. But my question to you, Wesley, is why does it require those two photons? Why can't one suffice?
Actually, we have a rotating ring that has the sensors in it, and those sensors are able to see that particle ray, which is in bandwidth of X-rays, and it creates the points. When you rotate it, then you create the map of this specimen that is the source of those positrons, and that's how you can scan the brain interaction.
Yes, Wesley, but you didn't answer the question. The question is, when you have a positron, it collides with an electron, they annihilate both, and the product are two gamma ray photons. So the question is, why are there two photons? Why not just one?
No, we don't have two gamma ray photons. We have two X-ray photons, not the gamma ray photons. That's the product of inhalation. You have mass that is disintegrated and changed to the energy. And to a chain. And that's actually, and the energy level in those two X-ray photons is equal to the product of collision and twitching.
AC2GS. No, I'm not getting my point across. A lot of physics is conservation of different things due to symmetry of these particles and fields and all kinds of fun stuff. And the thing that happens when a positron and electron collide is they both have momentum, and momentum is conserved. And photons also have momentum. So if you have one photon, the collision is a sum zero momentum because you have two things coming in from the opposite direction colliding. So if you have one photon come out, that's a non-zero momentum. So you have lack of conservation of momentum, which is not allowed in our universe. So you need to generate two photons in opposite directions so that the sum momentum of the two photons is the sum momentum of the two of the electron positron. And getting just back to Jeff, there's a lot of fuzzy illustrations and such. There's a lot of times you'll look up the electromagnetic spectrum, and they'll show you that there's a certain range which is called X-rays and another range which is called gamma rays. That is only in effect for astronomy because in astronomy they don't know the source. If you actually look at most definitions of gamma rays and X-rays, you will see listed that gamma rays are specifically generated from nuclear decay, and X-rays are specifically created from high-energy electrons. And, you know, a lot of times people get it sort of wrong, I guess. It sort of like goes back to what I was talking about months ago with diplexers and duplexers, that people get it wrong and they'll call a diplexer a duplexer. So if you check the definition for gamma rays and X-rays, most of the time you'll see the correct one, rather than the kind of fuzzy one where it's just the amount of energy defines both groups.
Thank you very much for that explanation. Let me clarify. The electron-positron annihilation annihilation is a result of beta plus decay's antimatter, and that's the positron, right? But talking about the electron-positron collision, electrons and positrons are typically regarded as point particles, so in order for them to collide, they would have the arbitrary close together, which would imply that over the course of the collision, they should have released arbitrary high amount of energy in form of kinetic energy. Then, of course, we have that kinetic energy with respect to the conservation of momentum. Did I say it properly? Okay, probably didn't. Okay, we were trying to get why is are those two X-rays going 180 degrees apart? Is that what's the core of the question?
Well, I mean, I asked why there were two and it was going 180 degrees apart, but I kind of answered that. And it's not really that beta decay causes matter-antimatter annihilation. It simply produces the material that then can occur as a particle-antiparticle. Like if you have a situation where something decays with a negative beta decay, it will produce a positron. And as the positron is escaping the nucleus, it very frequently will interact with one of the shell electrons. They'll annihilate each other. They'll produce photons, and the total number of electrons in the shell will diminish by one. So that would be in minus beta decay. But it's not the beta decay or the negative beta decay that produces the annihilation. It just produces the particle antiparticles that are capable of mutual annihilation. And it's not only the momentum that causes the energy of the photons, it's the rest mass also of the electron and the positron. Those have to be conserved as well. So the rest mass of an electron and a positron have to be converted into some form of energy, and that's electromagnetic energy. So that's where most of the energy goes on.
Thank you very much for this explanation. I think we were trying to touch conservation of electric charge and linear momentum of total energy. Did I say it right? Right. So that, and of course conservation of angular momentum. Thank you very much, and I think we just beat up the subject.
Okay. Don't think there's any angular momentum that needs balancing in that equation. It's mostly electron number is important. You have to conserve electron number. So an electron has an electron number of 1. A positron has an electron number of minus 1. So the total is 0. And the total electron number of photons is 0. So you're conserving electron numbers, and you're conserving momentum. And you're conserving charge. So there's a whole number of things that are quantities that tend to need to be conserved. I'm not quite sure if there's any angular momentum that needs to be particularly conserved in this, but okay.
I have a small puzzle about inductance. So you have a coil, right? And what is the condition for the inductance to be independent of the current magnitude so that it could be a linear inductor? And when do we have a nonlinear inductor, and what causes it? And thank you.
Is my understanding that fundamentally the only thing that determines differing inductance is the frequency of the current you put through it. Theoretically, I don't think if you increase the current per se, it changes the inductance or even the inductive reactance. So I'm not quite sure. I think inductance is somewhat fixed.
No, this is not the answer. We have a coil, right? Inductor, right? And we may have linear inductor, or we have nonlinear inductor. And the question is, what makes a linear coil nonlinear? In other words, a factor for linear conductor is that inductance is independent of the current magnitude. So we have a certain shape of the signal, and no matter how big amplitude we give, it's going to be so linear. But at certain situation, we have, and very often in our life, we have a coil that has non-linear characteristic. So I would like to get the answer when the coil is linear, when it's not.
Well, Wesley, I do not know. I assume the only nonlinear aspect to an inductor is probably more due to the core material saturating and having other effects. But otherwise, I don't understand. I don't think really just a standard copper coil of a given diameter has a different inductance based on any other factor.
Yeah, that's absolutely right answer. The air conductor, inductor, is linear. We deal with the transformer, we deal with electromagnet, we deal with a core. That core makes a coil in nonlinear. Intuition.
Okay.
So that's the end of the puzzle. But you had another puzzle probably to, you said you want to mention.
Well, yeah, I had it. It's not timely, so, you know, it'll work next week. It's already 10:16, so I don't want to delay Paul's SpaceNet report with an extra puzzle. I'll just save it for next Sunday night, hopefully.
AD2VHD.
Yes, VHD.
Hello, Roy. Nice job tonight. This is Jim, KD2VHD in Bayport. I had a short comment to add to your radiation discussion that might be practical for many folks.
Certainly, Jim. Please.
So, with the perfect example of the radiation under the floorboards, because things like that happen, some things that regular folks should keep in mind is that if you were to pick up the floorboards and there was like a lead-like block of radioactive material, and you took it out and put it in the right place, which you couldn't, but let's say you did, you might have solved the problem. But much more often, you would be dealing with dusts that are radioactive emitters. And you protect yourself from radiation from radioactive emitting sources by time, distance, and shielding. You get away. You don't spend a limited amount of time, or you put something between you and the radiation emitter. I'm going to let it drop for a second. In the case that the example I was used earlier, if the radiation source is under the floorboards and you in your house, well, you don't stand over that place in the floorboards all the time or for every minute of every day of your life. So some of the time you're shielded from it, and rather some of the time you're not exposed to it. And the floorboards have a certain amount of shielding. And the distance, you know, you're away from it, you're out of the house, you're at work. So those things are protecting you. Once you break that down, and if you remove a block of material, that's one thing, which is not right. But theoretically, you could improve the situation. But much more often you deal with dust, pieces of dust that you will touch, you will inhale, you will touch your hot dog bun, and you will eat your hot dog bun in you. And then you reduce your time to a situation of always being exposed, your distance to less than zero, and your shielding to less than zero, and it will hurt you. It applies to simple industrial stuff that you might find in a delivery truck or to radioactive fallout. Stay away from the dusts. That brings it from an emergency response perspective into a practical reality. Hope that's helpful.
Yes, it is, Jim. Thank you very much. I don't know if you're familiar with other aspects. Do you know offhand if the East Coast has a particular problem with radon gas, as far as you're aware?
I'm sorry, if what has a particular problem with the radon?
This area of the United States has a problem with radon gas in basements and such.
No, my background doesn't really speak to that very much. I don't have much input on that.
Okay. I just thought I would ask. I've heard it generally as a problem, but I haven't heard any local stories from anyone. So I always kind of thought it was a problem in some other states of the Union.
I think it exists most places, but some places it is definitely an issue. But no, I don't have much to add on that particular topic.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Jim. As always, good to have you here.
Thank you. I'll let it back to the scientists if they have any commentary on my thoughts. I think that makes, for the average man, if you know that, you know a lot more than most, and stay away from dust.
Okay, very good, Jim. Any other comments before we close the subject and this segment of the Technical Net tonight? Okay, David, I think you doubled with someone else, the other person, if you want to ID yourself.
Yeah, WS2N with a question, quick question for Jim.
Sure, please.
why the dust? Is it, you know, is it going to get into your eyes, or is it, my guess is probably you're worried about it getting into your lungs. Is that true?
You'll get it everywhere. The nature of it tends, because it's such a interestingly reactive and active type of, it tends to have charges and it sticks to things, and I don't know all the science of it, but the practical thing is it will get in your nose, it will get in your mouth, it will get in your lungs, it will get on your hands, it will get on your food, it will get in your clothes, you'll spread it to your, you know, it's, the dust gets everywhere. And it removes all time, distance, and shielding completely. And a little, something that would not bother you if you walk by it, once it gets in you, it will eventually finish you off because you're exposed to it for the rest of your life.
Interesting. Okay, thanks. It's all over you, not just your lungs. I'm thinking, well, you're going to wind up with lung cancer. But you're going to wind up with everything cancer. What you're saying. Very good. Thanks, Jim. Back to you, Roy.
Okay. I just want to put in my two cents worth. A lot of mildly radioactive material can't really pass through inert stuff. If, you know, depending upon, you know, a piece of paper or a foot of lead, it depends on how energetic and how small and how uncharged it is of what it can go through and what it can't go through. A lot of radioactive material, thankfully, is stopped by your skin. So it's a dead layer of cells, and it protects you. Most of the particles kind of get absorbed before they get anywhere near living cells that have nuclei, that have DNA that can be mutated. Now, once you get it on the inside of you, where you're filled instead of with skin, with mucous membranes and all kinds of fun stuff, it's right up against live cells. So, and it just keeps on being against live cells. You swallow it, you breathe it into your lungs, and it makes contact all over the place, and all those little particles that ordinarily would kind of get absorbed by your skin and be relatively harmless have a free channel to hit every nucleus it can get anywhere near. So that's one of the parts of why you want radioactive material as far away and preferably on the other side of your skin.
Agreed.
Okay, very good. We're all in agreement. David, you wanted to say something?
Yes, Roy. Do you know about this tea? It's called Mulane tea.
Not really. I know it's out there, and people make claims. People make claims about all kinds of things. I tend to disbelieve most claims, especially, you know, I mean, the health industry, you know, I'm sure they're wonderful people. They make billions of dollars, and I take a multivitamin. But to this day, there really have been few studies that demonstrate that unless you're suffering from severe malnutrition, food supplements have no beneficial effect whatsoever. So I would tend to put Mulane tea in that list. I don't think it does you any harm. So if it doesn't cost you too much and you like the taste of it, then so be it.
Mulane tea. Do you know what it does, or the claim that it cleans out the respiratory system, the lungs? And just the other day I took it, and the next morning when I woke up, all that stuff was coming up. You know, it's quite amazing. I don't know, you know, maybe there's some value in it. And I tried it more than once, and it works for me. So, do you know what it is?
Well, like I said before, I know of it. I know it's one of those things that you know, naturopaths and other people promote. I know that there are no particular studies that demonstrate its benefit, so it might be useful. it might not be. It might have been as useful if you had a regular cup of green tea. So, you know, the problem is that there's a lot of these natural herbal remedies, and some of them do work, and a lot of them don't. And it's very difficult to figure out which is which, and especially a lot of times these things are packaged in a really non-specific way. The amount of effective material, assuming there is an effective material, could be high, low, or non-existent, depending upon a lot of different factors. So most of these health food additives and such, it's very difficult to even know if it's effective, whether you're actually getting enough of it. Just the nature of the industry. They've done more than a few studies where they pulled out these vitamin supplements and tested them for the vitamins and found that they weren't there. So, you know, who knows?
QSL. Leave that for now. You know, you remember, was it 1 or 2 weeks ago, I mentioned to you about the hypersonic missile that China tested and flew all the way around the world. And now, you know, we're getting word about China and Taiwan and what's going on. And I don't know how it happened 2 weeks ago. Nobody knew anything about it.
Well, they're not an open society, and they don't tell you things, and especially the old Soviet Union was a lot like that. It wasn't until they were successful with something that they announced it. And to my knowledge, and Paul might disagree because he knows this thing much better than me, a lot of times they just kind of came out and they said, yeah, we put Sputnik up there, rather than saying, we're going to put Sputnik up there, we're starting to put Sputnik up there, yes, it stayed up there. Because I think they had a lot of disasters that they would rather not mention in the first place. Some of them you can't hide, like recent the Chinese rocket that's been falling all over the world lately. So that's just the nature of China. It's a very closed society. It's run by the Chinese Communist Party, and they lock down the internet. They lock down journalism. You can't write anything unless it's approved by a censor. And so I wouldn't expect to find out a lot of details about a lot of the random things there.
Yes, and our president started talking, was it yesterday or the day before, about making microchips in the United States. I guess in response, you know, to having to deal with Taiwan and China. So, you know, all of a sudden it's become very newsworthy.
Well, Taiwan is a friendly nation. We're on very, very good terms to Taiwan. The Chinese do not like that because they see Taiwan as part of communist China. Never was part of communist China. It was part of China before the communists took over. So we're good relations with Taiwan, but because of the chip shortage and other factors, the United States would like to have United States-based high-end semiconductors. It's incredibly important for industry. You see all around you, car sales plummeted and supplies shrunk just because of the control chips weren't available for manufacture of cars, and that has had an impact on all kinds of electronic equipment, and almost everything these days is electronic, just because of the ubiquity of silicon chips and such. So I think it's a reasonably smart move for the United States to invest in high-end foundries. I think, unfortunately, it's going to lead to losing a lot of money, because if everyone manufactures silicon, then there's a lot of competition and the price goes down. The plus part is you'll be able to buy thumb drives for probably 10 cents at some point. The downside is that people are channeling billions and billions of investment dollars into all these foundries, and there's only so many foundries really necessary, but, you know, that's the nature of things.
Yes, but according to our president, who said that we need these computer microchips for just about every single everyday item, you know, like radios and air conditioners and cars and computers, etc., etc., etc. And he wants for the United States to be independent with computer microchips and not have to depend on any other country. But I think it also ties into Taiwan, because that's where we have been getting them. And now China's acting tough, even saying things about anyone to visit China from the United States, beware, and all this other stuff, and, you know, they send this thing around the world, and the United States has probably got something up their sleeve.
Well, in one way or another, and I don't want to veer too much into politics, and I don't want to take up too much of Paul's time, the Chinese have always been saber-rattling from the get-go. They do all kinds of things. If a company anywhere related to China is making a map, they have to color it so that Taiwan is part of the People's Republic of China and not a separate country, and all kinds of foolishness like that. So they've been rattling their sabers since Mao Zedong's time. They have kind of increased that with Xi Jinping. He's kind of turned himself into a little bit of a Mao guy. He has his own little book, and his thoughts get published in the newspaper every day, and there's big pictures of him all around, and everyone, you know, blesses him and such, so it's a little scary that way. But still, even if there wasn't these problems with China and it wanting Taiwan, just the past chip shortage alone, which had nothing really to do with that, it had to do with COVID and other factors, makes you want to think that a high-end silicon is really fundamental to an economy. You can't maintain an economy in the 21st century without a dedicated source for these chips. And so although there will probably be a glut in the market and money will be lost, sometimes it pays simply to have your own supply of things just in case for a rainy day. Yes, Wesley, I want to kind of wrap this up because I don't want to take too much time away from Paul.
It's 5 cents. The proton accelerator that is going to replace cyclotrons and synchrotrons, the one that I said is about $20 million, which is the silicon plated with gold, is based on spin-off of a Department of Energy device that was used to inspect nuclear weapons. And that one is using the insulators, and this insulator is actually silicon, or silica. They use the photoconductive switch, and coming to the antennas, which is our field, that switch is actually an antenna that is used for generation detection of pulse terahertz radiation. And that was discovered by David Alston, who developed the technology in Bell Labs in 1960s. So here we are. We have some kind of revolution that is taking place here. Enter in.
Okay. Very good. Thanks. David, hopefully, any closing comments? Well, I guess not. With that, let's go to Paul, WS2N, with the SpaceNet report.
Thanks, Roy, ATTGS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And, you were talking about the Russians keeping things quiet. That's why I remember years ago on this net we talked about, I think I posed it as a quiz question. You know, who was the first person to actually go, you know, into orbit around Earth and come back and land in their vehicle safely on, you know, back on Earth. You know, and everybody, of course, would normally say the Russians, you know, Yuri Gagarin, you know, did that. But in reality, the one that made it safely back with their vehicle was John Glenn, because the Russians kept it quiet, and we didn't know it. I mean, I'm of age to remember those flights. And we thought, yeah, the Russians went around the Earth with Yuri Gagarin, and he came back and landed in a spacecraft. Let me drop it. Well, most of it was right until the last couple of miles, because what they would do is they would bail out. I mean, the hatch would blow before they, you know, as they're coming down after the main parachute has been opened. And as they're coming down, the hatch would blow, and the seat would, they ignited a little solid motors, solid booster rockets on a seat. It was essentially an ejection seat. They'd come flying out, and they would parachute down to the ground. And the first few missions were like that. But John Glenn was the first one to actually go all the way around and land. Of course, he landed in the water, but that's still Earth. Any comments?
Yeah, question. In regards to Russian, can you comment on the 2 days ago Russian announcement of withdrawal from the space program and International Space Station and Russia?
Yeah, well, you know, that's part of what I have tonight. But yes, that is expected to happen now. They haven't actually formalized a letter to NASA yet. You know, this is just one guy that took over from Dmitry Rogozin. He, you know, they laid him off from the from Roscosmos, and they got this other guy, and I don't think he was there a day, and he right away he's saying that no more space station after 2024. Well, we'll see what happens. You know, I don't. You know, if they pull out, they pull out. I think by then we might come up with a plan B, but we'll see. I mean, what are they going to do? Are they going to disconnect their modules and float away? And the latest thing that I read was okay. The guy says we're not going to disconnect, or we're not going to stop going to the space station until we actually build our own space station and send it up to space. With all the sanctions and everything, I don't think they got two rubles to rub together to do that. I think if they did, they would just keep funding the existing part of the space station that they're in right now. But we'll see. Back to you, Wes.
Actually, the guy's name is Dmitry Rogozin. He was for many years on the top of Russian space program and Roscosmos, and he became famous for saying that Americans will deliver their astronauts with trampoline because Russians would not help them to get there. And then we had the announcement of Elon Musk that the Batut is actually the trampoline. Yeah, but my question is how important to our space program is Russian involvement there, Andrew?
Yeah, Dmitry Rogozin, is that what you're saying? Okay. Well, he's been there for a while, and once the sanctions started with the 2014 invasion of the Ukraine, he was the one that came out with that, because we won't let the United States on the Soyuz crap anymore. If you want to get to the space station, bounce on a trampoline. He came out with a lot of weird things. He said that, you know, they hole drilled in the orbital section of one of the Soyuz manned spacecraft that was attached to the space station. A little fine, like 10-millimeter hole. Oh yeah, one of our astronauts, we did that. Yeah, we drilled the hole. Said that woman astronaut that was up there wanted to get back home and figured that would be the way to do it, create an air leak and they'll rush her home. Nonsense. So I'm glad he's gone, but who knows what this next guy is gonna do. Right now, the next guy says he wants to pull out of the space station. We'll see. I'm not too concerned, by the way, Wesley. We'll see what happens. Let me just go down a quick list of the few things that I have here. This WS2F. Okay. And by the way, the CHIPS deal that they signed, there's always things that get thrown in with these bills, and one of the things that got signed that's part of that is for NASA, a larger amount of money, and there's statements in that bill which authorizes NASA to really go ahead with future manned moon missions and future Mars missions. We haven't had this in like over 5 years. There's been delay after delay, and part of the approval of that CHIPS program includes that, and also includes keeping the space station going from all the way to 2030. So I mean that's putting a bow on it. Those people now at NASA will be committed to keeping the space station alive till 2030. I mean, if there's problems with propulsion or whatever, I think they're, knowing NASA, they will find a way around it. First thing I was going to talk about came out tonight on the news. If you put the news on, probably every station, they're talking about Michelle Nichols, lady that played Lieutenant Uhura on the Star Trek, is now unfortunately deceased. She made it to 89 years old. I think she's been sick. She had some, I don't know if it was Alzheimer's or something of that nature over the last few years. But that's a big loss. She was very good at promoting NASA. She would do NASA commercials. You know, you put on the NASA station and you would see promotions by her talking about the space program going back, you know, to the early space shuttle missions. Let me drop it. She also got involved actually with the, you know, as a practical worker for NASA. They put her on board the Sophia 747. Sophia was a 747, or still is, with a large telescope sticking out of the back side of the airplane, and it had a 8-foot diameter mirror, you know, as big as a Hubble, and it would point to the sky, and it would fly to different places. And she actually got to fly on quite a few of those missions as one of the operators. But that's a shame, but that's the way it goes. Let me move on. She'll be missed, and let me move on to the STS talking about actual what NASA could do when they put their mind to it. This mission has been delayed for many, many years, over budget and all, called the, now it's called Artemis, and the Artemis one was, you know, it's going to be launched on the SLS space launch system at the end of this month now. You know, it's been out to the launch pad quite a few times now. They roll it out on the crawler, and they look for problems, they find problems, they bring it back to the vehicle assembly building, work on it, board it back out again a couple of months later. And then recently they found some problems with they call it a collet, which created a, you know, it's just a mechanical part, which created a hydrogen leak. And, you know, they were testing it out at the pad, loading up the liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen in the core. And they did find a leak, actually on the discharge part, you know, where you always vent off hydrogen and oxygen when it gets up to pressure. And then they found a leak, one of the detectives found it, so they managed to replace all of that. And they did a few other things that they wanted to do back at the vehicle assembly building. Now it's going to be going back out to the pad, and they plan on they got a date now, the 29th of August, so at the end of this month, at 8:33 a.m., you know, they have a couple of different windows that open up, but, you know, if they manage to get up on time, instead of, you know, a few delays, I wouldn't be surprised if there are delays, any new rocket system, that tends to happen, but who knows, they might get off the ground. Doesn't have a crew. The top of the spacecraft is the Orion spacecraft. It could handle easily up to 4 people to go into space. This is a rehearsal for that eventual mission, which will take place in about a year and a half. This one's going to go around the moon, probably maybe 4 weeks, 5 weeks, and eventually come back. It'll be orbiting the moon for quite a bit of time, and then it will return to Earth and land in the Pacific Ocean. On board, they have an Alexa setup. They call it Callisto. I guess they're going to say Callisto, do this, do that. You know, they'll be able to do that for mission control. They also have cameras on board. They'll be able to see what a crew member would see. There's a screen there. They're going to transmit television pictures to and from the spacecraft. So everything's designed to duplicate as if a crew was on board. They do have a mannequin on board, and all set up with a spacesuit and all kinds of telemetry on it to relay back, you know, all the vibrations and everything this is going to feel. An astronaut would feel if they were really going. So looking forward to the Artemis 1 project. Artemis 2 will be about a year and a half from now, and that will duplicate this flight, do exactly what this one is doing, orbit the moon for many weeks at a time and eventually come back and land in the Pacific Ocean. Artemis 3, they plan on actually landing on the moon with that one. We'll see how that works out. That would be probably a year after that. Probably 2025 is the predicted date now. Any comments or questions? Okay, we talked about China before. Well, China has now doubled the size of their manned space station. You know, we have 7 people on board the International Space Station right now. By the way, there was a pass earlier tonight, but unfortunately there were clouds here. A little after 9 o'clock. But, you know, when that thing goes overhead and the sun is reflecting off it, usually early in the morning or at dusk, you can actually see the space station. Now you could also do that with the Chinese space station. I think Heavens Above has the times that you can see that. I haven't done that one yet. But anyway, it's now going to be easier to see because it was roughly 50 feet long, 14 feet in diameter, plus it had the equivalent of a Progress cargo vehicle attached to it. It also has a manned spacecraft, they call it a Shinzo spacecraft, attached to the other end. So there's three people on board right now. So in China, they launched a heavy lift vehicle the other day and took up another module, another 50, roughly 50-foot long module, you know, 14 feet in diameter. So it's going to roughly double the size of what they have up there now. And eventually, I think in October, they're going to send up a third one with the option of adding three more years down the road. But they'll be happy with three. And then we'll be able to have a steady crew of three. If they ever increase the size again, they'll probably have a steady crew of six. So they're moving along. This was the flight that made all the news because the upper stage weighs over 20 tons. It's going to re-enter the atmosphere, and which it did, by the way. It wound up burning up, they said, over South Asia somewhere. I don't know, an island called Borneo. And apparently some people took pictures of it. This was the one. They've gone through this. This is the third time. They think nothing of launching these things without any way of reigniting the thrusters or having additional thrusters, sometimes called Ehrlich thrusters. Something to slow it down and bring it down over a predicted location, usually the South Pacific. None of that. They just launch it up, and wherever it comes down, and they hope it all burns up, which it don't. You can't take a 20-ton piece of hardware and put it into space and expect it all to burn up, especially like the engine parts. And, you know, I mean, these things survive thousands of degrees of heat when they're going into space. They're not going to burn up as easily as they come through the atmosphere. But that's China for you. You know, the international community is trying to get after them for doing this stuff. But, they don't want to listen to anybody, I guess, until somebody gets hurt. I mean, probably the chances of this thing actually hitting a civilian area is probably, I think that I read, 99% chance of landing in, let's say, in the water or on land somewhere. Still leaves 1% or more of actually hitting something. How they get away with it, they need to have, you know, some kind of deal with all the space-faring countries and get after these people. Sooner or later, you know, you launch 100 flights and maybe that 1%, something might hit somebody. Any comments? Okay, I really haven't talked about this mission much. This is a South Korean flight spacecraft that they want to put around the moon. It's called the South Korean Pathfinder Lunar Orbiter. And it's all built. It's already been shipped. It's out. It's at it in Florida already. SpaceX is actually going to launch it for Korea. South Korea does have their own launch vehicle now, but they signed up with SpaceX, a while back. But their lift vehicle might not be might not be as powerful, not yet. But they're getting there. And their goal is to actually have future astronauts, maybe part of the Artemis program, go up with NASA. actually go to the moon. They want to eventually put a lander on the moon. But for now, they'd be happy to get their first spacecraft in orbit around the moon, the Korean Pathfinder. Lunar Orbiter will be launched on a Falcon 9 rocket from Launch Complex 40 down in Florida. And it will be going up this week. Morning flight, 7:08 a.m. On this Thursday. So we'll see how that goes. It's going to take a very long time to get the spacecraft into orbit. They're following a trajectory that the Capstone launch from New Zealand is doing. Rocket Lab launched a spacecraft for NASA from New Zealand a few weeks ago called Capstone, and it's going to go into this unusual orbit around the moon. They plan on going into like a 40,000 mile high for apogee and 1,000 mile perigee. Very, you know, that'll be the low point. But to get there, they passed the moon. The Capstone has already passed the moon, and it's heading out to what they call L1, Lagrange Point 1, which is a million miles away from the Earth, toward the Sun. Lagrange Point 2, that's where James Webb Space Telescope is. That's the other direction. This one is going to Lagrange Point 1. But it's not going to stay there. We have sent spacecraft there, Discover, ACE, SOHO, to that location before. But they fire little thrusts and then they stay there. This one is going to just get there, and then it's going to stop, and then the Earth's gravity and the Moon's gravity combined will start to pull that spacecraft back again, back toward the Moon. And eventually when it gets close to the Moon, then it'll be going just the right speed, and they'll have little thrusters go off, and that Capstone will go into that highly elliptical orbit. This one, the Korea Pathfinder Lunar Orbiter, they want to go into a low orbit, you know, like 60 or 70 miles above the surface of the Moon. But to do that, they're going to do the same thing. That just on the way back, they'll just have a different trajectory to get into a low lunar orbit. And they, again, plan on going all the way out to L1, which is, you know, sounds weird, but, you know, four times the distance from the Moon, a million miles out, and then eventually coming back to that 233,000 mile location. But it saves rocket fuel. If they were, and you could have a smaller spacecraft, if you were to just go out to the Moon like Apollo did, or what Artemis is going to do. Of course, they have people on there. They can't spend months. By the way, Capstone will go into orbit in November around the Moon. This thing here will launch on Thursday. It won't be into orbit until December, so it's like over 5 months to do this. But there's nobody on board. You don't have to worry about it. Artemis and Apollo, you know, they blast off in, you know, 3.5 days. They're at the Moon, and then they fly to retros, which takes a lot of fuel, a bigger vehicle, and to do that. So that would slow them down and go around the Moon that way. This is a less expensive way of doing it. You could have less fuel, less mass, go all the way out to L1, and then just lightly float back to where you want to be. Anyway, NASA has an instrument on board. There's, I think, a half a dozen different instruments. This is an orbiter. It's going to take all kinds of pictures, you know, X-ray, all kinds of information for South Korea. But of course, NASA has put a camera on board. They call it the Dark Shadow Camera. Well, what it is an upgraded camera from a camera that's already on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. NASA put that orbiter around the Moon in 2009, so it's been up there all these years. and had a camera and I could look into craters and, you know, try to figure out if there was, you know, ice at the bottom of the crater, you know, with the air cameras. Now, time has gone by.